Hello, everybody. Welcome to a Super Network interview. You're joined here with Super Marcy and my one and only co-host and co-everything at the Super Network, Mr. Bede Jermaine. Hello, Bede. How are we doing?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing good. I'm a little bit excited because we have, yes, another wonderful interview coming at everybody. And we will be talking with the director, but also many other things in the new Australian Aussie horror thriller, Crow Valley.
Indeed. And that, of course, is Josh Conn. Hello, Josh. How are you?
G'day, guys. Good to see you. Good to chat.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time out to chat with us today.
No problem.
So just if people are not sure about the film, it is about a mountain biker played by yourself, and you set off on a remote weekend to ride your bike in Crow Valley, but there's a bit of a hit and run accident and he's very badly injured, but a hitchhiker takes him in, but not everything is as it seems.
This is true. Yeah, you've nailed it on the head. That's what happens. And then lots of chasing and stabbing and running and blood and all that type of stuff. So it's good fun.
Yeah, there's all sorts going on. And it's like a unsettling opening scene, which kind of gives us an indication of what's kind of to come. And then we have like a, you know, not a slow build up, but enough build up to be like, this is the character, they're going out somewhere. Maybe it's not a good place to go. We don't know what it could be. Where did these ideas for this come from? Like,
It was really because it was a first feature, I was being a bit kind of strategic and thinking about how I could write a story that was contained but really focused on the audience and gave them kind of something to engage with. So it was that idea of keeping it small but making sure there was lots of interesting stuff happening, and also really the best possible characters we could have. And the thing about Benny and Greta is that it is a bit of a slow burn at the start, but as the movie goes on, we find out more and more about them. And, you know, there's quite a backstory and there's a lot of things that are revealed. And I think that's part of the fun with this type of movie, is that those kind of elements that you suddenly realise, oh, my God, that's why they're doing that, or that's why they're doing that. So the idea was to have this movie that just kept revealing more and more as it went along until you kind of hit that final act and it's just, you know, things are going pretty crazy, which I think we achieved pretty well. It gets pretty crazy towards the end, which I was pretty
happy. It does. It went to fuck this shit o'clock pretty quickly when it gets to the third act.
That's a good way to describe it. Certainly
I'd say so. Bede, I'm sure you have some burning questions.
Yeah, well, I was watching the film and I sort of kind of noticed like there was a lot of influences of previous work in the film. And I was sort of wondering, like, which films did you look to as inspirations for the story of Crow Valley?
It's interesting. Not a lot, which sounds weird because there's obviously I love movies, like all types of movies. I love rom-coms. I love horror. I love drama. I love action. You know, I'll sit down and watch The Seventh Seal and then watch John Wick. I don't care. I'm going to watch it all. But with Crow Valley, there was that, I guess, because I'd been screenwriting for a while, characters were real focus. So the plotting kind of came out of the characters, really, once I started building it up. And the initial setup was really getting back to that idea of what I could actually do. So initially, Benny was going to be a mountain climber, but then we realised that that would be really hard to do and probably risky, and riding a bike is much safer. So there was lots of decisions like that, but the focus was really on developing the characters and making sure that the kind of the plot was propulsive enough that it kept people involved once they started watching. So that was the plan. But, like, influences, oh, God, there's so many influences. The kind of influenced me as a filmmaker, but perhaps don't necessarily would obviously link to the movie. But I love character-driven stuff. I love Paul Thomas Anderson, which sounds crazy, but his latest one, Licorice Pizza, I loved. And also There Will Be Blood is one of my favourite movies of all time. God damn, I love that movie. The anti-hero thing. I do love anti-heroes as well. And I guess Benny is a little bit kind of on that spectrum, which is good. And I really kind of really like that character trait about him. And also Greta is, you know, it's interesting because it was kind of hard to, because it was such a small kind of list of characters, it was tricky to, because when I first wrote Greta, she was quite kind of single note and, you know, she was evil and, you know, if girls could have mustaches and twirl them, I'm sure she would have been doing that as a character. But so it was really that writing process was trying to develop her and make her as interesting as possible. So, yeah, hopefully we did that. But I love all types of movies. It would be weird to probably what I say influences would probably be crazy, but... yeah, there was all types of movies of an influence, but probably from horror. Now I'm starting to just bang on. Favorite horror movies would probably be The Shining, which in a way is quite a contained two-person horror movie, similar to Crow Valley, and one goes a bit crazy. So there's parallels there. And the other one is The Thing, which John Carpenter's The Thing, which I goddamn, that's such a good movie as far as paranoia and building tension. I don't think there's a better movie out there, which is crazy because, you know, they both bombed at the box office when they came out. So it's a funny thing with movies, what works and what doesn't and what survives over the years, which is always a big kind of tell of quality. But yeah, those two movies definitely had an impact.
Yeah, I think you can see that as you've mentioned it with that isolation and the concentration on sort of two central characters. And I think it works in Crow Valley because we kind of get to know your characters a little bit and then something happens and then we kind of get more insight into Greta. And I do like how you sort of get these reveals as it goes on. And if you're paying enough attention, you'd probably be able to figure it out. But
I can never figure anything out.
I was paying attention and I'm still like, I didn't see that. What the? Caught me off guard completely, which doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, I'm the same. Like with obviously writing it, you're feeding in all these little reveals. But when I watch stuff, I'll watch it with Shell, my wife, and I'll be always like, what? Why did that happen? I don't get it. Oh, you know, that's a pain in the ass when I watch movies sometimes. But yeah, I never know what's going on. But that's good that it kind of had that impact on you. I'm really glad to hear that. That's good.
Yeah, there were a few little reveals and I was like, oh, which is always good. I like when a movie can do that.
Yeah, that is really good.
Pete.
Well, in the movie, you juggle quite a lot of hats. Not only are you the director, the writer, producer, and editor, but you're also the star of the film. What was the whole process of juggling so many hats for this one film?
A lack of money. It's really, that was as simple as that. I didn't have any money and I was thinking, how am I going to do this? And then I thought, I'll just get started. And it was kind of, you know, those titles they put on people with movies. This movie was really, there was three main people and we had a mountain of help from friends and family who came along and, you know, shot, you know, operated the camera. And my uncle operated the camera for like three vital scenes because we couldn't get anyone else. He did an awesome job, Uncle Ian, and he also supplied the truck. So there was all these people. But getting back to the core trio, it was Nicole Freeman, who's obviously she plays Greta, and she was a huge part of the project and, you know, a great actress, but just a great person and just chipped in and just went hard, just any job, totally got stuck in. And she was quite young when we started filming it, I think she was 19, because we went and kind of filmed it for nearly 18 months. And her commitment at that age just astonished me, because I remember thinking, God, when I was 18, I was just drinking beer and running around like a crazy man. And she was just, she was so good and worked so hard. And yeah, she was great to have on board. And the second person was Adrian Olsen, who's a mate of mine from uni. And Adrian was a photographer and he's an architect. And he filmed most of it. And he has a great, obviously being an architect, eye for detail, just crazy eye for detail, and also a really accomplished photographer. So he just jumped in and, you know, just worked his ass off as well. So it was really the three of us. And like we would, like you talk about directing, like I would be acting and Nicole would go, do it again, do it better. So we all kind of helped each other. It was a real kind of collaborative process. And it was, and I think that's what made it fun, because we'd go off and do this on weekends and it was just like, you know, we were hanging out with mates and making a movie and making fake blood and pouring it over each other. And, well, not Adrian, he didn't get any on him, but lucky bugger, because it's sticky stuff. But, yeah, it was just great fun. And that core three were, you know, were kind of instrumental.
Yeah, like just watching it, well, I watched it last night to prep to speak to you, so it was all fresh. What strikes me is that it looks really like it almost looks pristine, in that it is really nicely shot, it is really nicely framed, and you don't have too many edits that are real, like, ridiculous. Like, you kind of need to have an edit if you can't afford to show someone getting smashed by a car. But I think the impact of how it cuts together actually works really well. So for what little money you may have had, it looks really damn good. Tip my invisible hat off.
I appreciate the tip of your invisible hat. That's awesome. That's really nice of you to say. Yeah, really appreciate that. I was particularly proud of our car stunt, because I performed the car stunt. And I didn't tell my wife I did it at the time, because it was our car as well.
Oh,
we did it backwards, because obviously you're not going to be able to do it forward. So I rolled down the front of the car, down as the car moved slowly backwards, and then onto the ground. And then we obviously flipped and ran around backwards. But it worked so well. I was so pleased with it. And but that's that in- it's interesting filmmaking. There's a bit of problem solving and old fashioned ingenuity, pardon me, with it. And I was watching just recently, there's a doco on Industrial Light and Magic. I don't know whether you guys have seen it. It's just popped up on Disney. And I've been loving that, because it shows how movies are so, even at that level, are so kind of crafty and homespun. Like when you saw them, what they did with Star Wars, they were building models and they had sticks, and all they did was have this, the one thing that made the big difference was the motion control cameras, and everything else was ingenuity. And that's part of the fun with movies, and especially with a movie like this where you don't have any money. It's that, how we get, well, we need someone to roll over the car. We can't pay for a stuntman. How are we going to do it? And, yeah, that the fun of figuring that stuff out is a big part of it.
And I would never have guessed that was filmed in reverse.
Filmed in reverse.
And, yeah, like...
I think John Wick, half of John Wick was filmed in reverse. But I just...
in the last couple of years, Bede and I have been having a journey through Ausploitation films. And we're trying to cover like five films every month starting from the beginning. So as we've watched through Australian cheap, low budget movies from the 70s, you see a lot of that ingenuity, just homemade weird things that people have come up with, and just the amount of raw stunts people did back then and just didn't care. It's you have such an appreciation for what goes into just making something, and you might not think it took a lot, but then you understand that, yeah, it kind of did. So
that I just read a book
on. You can
on,
see that.
Yeah, absolutely, Marcy. You're so right. That's such a good project to have, the looking at Ausploitation. I haven't seen a bunch of them, but obviously Mad Max for me was one of those movies that just had a massive impact on me as a kid. I'm way too young to watch it when I first watched it, considering the content of what happened in that movie. But just blew my mind and loved it so much. But, yeah, in the book, like reading how they went about it, it was just crazy what they were doing. Like they were doing that stuff on roads that weren't closed down. They'd set up their own, you know, people, but they were pretty much public roads. And what he achieved in that movie is kind of stunning. And it's no wonder that he, you know, George Miller's gone on to have this massive career. And obviously Mad Max 2 was another thing that really blew my mind apart at that stage. What other Ozploitation movies have you been watching?
Ooh. Where do we even start?
That's definitely one for me.
Yeah, well, we have covered Mad Max recently on the show, and we've also covered like other action films like the Chain Reaction, The Man from Hong Kong, Deaf Cheetahs, Stunt Rock, like particularly a lot of work from Brian Trenchard-Smith.
I just saw the preview of it was on – I just came across it on YouTube because it just – re-released Stunt Rock, haven't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And I had never come across it before, and as soon as I saw the preview, I shared the link to all my friends because I haven't seen it yet, and I can't believe I haven't seen it because it looks like the most amazing movie ever. But, yeah, what did you guys think of it?
It's a lot of fun.
If you like
theatrical concerts with really weird theatrics and then amazing stunts and the always wonderfully charismatic Grant Page, it's just fun. Like,
I've got to see it.
It's such an example of making a film with next to no plot, but it's so enjoyable and fun because it's just people hanging out. There's good friendships that you see formed. There's crazy concert theatrics and you get to see a lot of the stunt work that Grant Page did, and it's like, how did you do all this stuff?
You read stuff about him. He was, I guess, such a big part of all those movies at that time, and probably and it's interesting talking about, you know, people talk about directors and that type of thing, but these other people who come in and elevate the movie by what they do, and he's such a good example of that. Like the stunts that he performed during that period were off the charts and, you know, probably made these movies so much more of a landmark through his input. And, you know, also just really putting his life on the line sometimes.
Things
he did. It's crazy. But, that is an awesome period in Aussie. And it's interesting too, it's that strange period in Aussie film too where you had that, but then you had that other side where you had your Hanging Rocks and Last Waves and those types of things. I just watched recently The Last Wave, and I hadn't seen it in ages. And I also just recently watched Picnic and Hanging Rock. I've never seen that either. And I was amazed by it, actually. I thought it was so good. And also, who's the Aussie actor? Oh, I forgot his name. Wolf Creek, John Jarrett.
Oh, John Jarrett, yes.
He's in Picnic and Hanging Rock. So that was, it was like, oh, my God, that's John Jarrett. Yeah, so that was cool.
It's actually really weird as we watch these movies, we're seeing the same people show up. Mm. Oh, it's that guy. Oh, it's that guy. Like, it's bizarre, but it's also really interesting. But also, like, Peter Weir, who directed Picnic at Hanging Rock, like these are some of like his earlier films, and I'd never even heard of them until we started this project.
Yeah, so like one him
to discover all these things. And
he's Gallipoli, I think, is one of the most perfect movies ever made. And it's interesting, you know, that test with movies, no matter where you start watching them, so you come across them on telly and it's like halfway through or three quarters of the way through and you find, oh, I'll sit here and I'll watch the rest of it. And that always had, Gallipoli always has that effect on me. And it was interesting too. That was a good point, Marcy, about people who turned up a lot. And I used to think that as a kid. It's like, oh, you always had the same people. But what I realised is those actors who were jobbing actors back then, they were good. Like, they were high quality. They were talented people doing some really good work. And obviously, I guess the industry was so small back then because the money, there was so much money required to make a film. And so whereas now, you know, it's so much more available to so many more people, which is fantastic. Mm. But you had these really talented people doing some great work. So, yeah, it was such a great era for Aussie film.
Yeah, when you consider you had Ausploitation movies, as you mentioned, to like Picnic at Hanging Rock, and you had like a lot of acclaimed films, and I think that was like a big discovery period in Australian cinema.
It was that, they called it that golden age of Aussie cinema.
Yeah, it's
late 70s, early 80s.
Very interesting to watch, and yeah, I think you definitely get an appreciation for what can be achieved on just little money with a film, just a lot of passion. And I think you, going back to your movie, we can definitely see that you had passion for what you were doing, especially for, I guess, like a first feature.
Yeah, it's incredible amount of work. It's when you short movies, because we made a few short movies, and there's obviously a lot of effort that goes into these, goes into those, and not to diminish anyone who's made a short movie, because they are tough to do and tough to do well. But I would just say it's not harder than a short movie, but just the amount of work to do a feature is so much more.
Mm.
And you really need a bit of staying power and keep going at it. I remember there was a time that I thought my brain was going to break because we'd done the edit and I'd done it all on this particular program, and then the sound guy needed, this is quite boring, but a particular file, and then I had to do this computer stuff. I'll keep it at that. And halfway through I thought, my brain is going to break. I can't cope with this. This is too much for me. But it happened. I figured it out. But, yeah, it's those types of challenges that you don't see coming that make it really hard. But it's really satisfying. I think the satisfying thing with making a feature is you stand back and go, holy crap, I made a feature. That's insane. And also it's such a document, because it's quite a significant piece of work. Like it's a significant piece of art. It has, you know, obviously movies combined writing and that cinematography, but all the work behind the scenes to make it happen. It's a lot of work, and it's kind of, once you finish doing it and you have this thing, it's something to be really proud of, because it's you know they say that movies don't want to get made. You really have to force them to be made. And it feels like that sometimes. So when you finally get it all done, it's really satisfying.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, for sure. But what I think is interesting about Crow Valley as a film is the complexity of our two main characters. Like, you could easily have made, like, one a villain and one sort of the victim slash hero. But I think what's interesting is that you bring a lot of nuance to these characters, that they're both kind of dealing with their own things.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, strangely, and not to give away what happens at the end, in a way, the story also becomes about redemption for at least both of these characters in a way. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, like, how do your approach to these characters... I'll say that again. In terms of, how did you go with approaching these characters in that way?
It was a long, like as I said earlier, the writing process took about a year, and I did about 3 page one rewrites, which is like, okay, let's start again. But I was really interested in making sure the characters weren't single note. And there is, like, certain horror movies, you can do that. You can have really simple characters, and because you just have a monster and you have people running away from the monster, and that's enough for certain stories, and that's great, and there's fantastic horror movies that do that. But I guess thinking about the limitations we had and having just 2 people and sustaining a story over, you know, that hour and a half running time, I guess we struggled because there wasn't that many people we could kill in the classic horror movie style. So we were, in order to keep people interested, we were going to have to really lean on our characters to maintain that interest. And Martin Scorsese, my good friend Martin Scorsese, said, I wish, said once, oh, you know, characters will keep people riveted to a story more than plot, more than special effects, more than anything else. And I kind of agree with that, because when you think about, you know, really great movies you keep going back to, it kind of is the character that you go back for in a way. So I guess a good example would be, and a classic example would be Indiana Jones, which is just a, I guess if you look at it, an action movie with these great action set pieces. But I think what set that apart when it came out was this new type of hero. And I think they, in the slow line, they even said a new era of hero or something like that. But it was that what Harrison Ford brought to it was this kind of vulnerability that perhaps we hadn't seen in that daring do type of character. So it was that slight tweak that, and it was a character tweak that probably really lifted that into another stratosphere and made it this iconic thing that's been going on for 40 years now. So yeah, character. It's all about character. So says my good friend Martin Scorsese.
He's a good friend to us all.
Yes. He's been a good friend.
I'll go ring him later. Take my call, Mr. Scorsese.
Yes.
So we have, you've talked about what Nicole Freeman, she did a lot of work, not just acting in it, but like she's really fantastic in the film. How did you come across her?
Well, she was in one of our short films, and actually a friend of a friend knew her, because I was looking for a person to play this particular character in a short movie. So they said, oh, get Nicole, she's really good. So we did, and then we just kind of got to know each other really well, and she's such a nice person. So when this project came about, she was kind of the first person I thought to ask to get involved, and she was more than happy to jump in. And as I said before, Nicole's such a she's such a great personality, because she's so down to earth, and she's just got a work ethic that, you know, just you wouldn't believe. And she's obviously she's super busy at the moment, because she's producing all these film clips and doing all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, she's going great guns, and she was a huge part of the project. And also, as you said, that she's just a really natural actress. Acting, I think, is funny sometimes, because I think there's something really innate about people who can act, and I reckon it has something to do with the way your brain works and having a really overactive imagination and just being able to kind of, yeah, let's pretend this and then just go straight there. And she can do that. So it's really cool to watch. And she brings a lot to that character. And she also has that kind of that sense of depth to her when you see her on screen as well. So, and I think that's kind of that little bit of an X factor that's hard to kind of just manufacture as well. So she was awesome, and we all love her, so she's great.
Yeah, she was amazing. Like the things that we see, the character goes from highs and lows, and the way that she handled that, it just felt very seamless.
And also
she was very captivating.
Yeah, she was. And that, and also that she did manage to do that over a period of about 16 months. So to kind of go off and do your normal life, it's, you know, there's that idea of being very method and just going into the character, which she could never do, because she had to go off and do day jobs and all that type of stuff. And then on the weekends kind of bounce into this character that was quite kind of crazy and complex and had all these things going on. So she, that was, you know, lots of credit to her as well for being able to do that.
Yes, definitely. Just I was honestly blown away. I just thought, wow.
Yeah, I was as well.
To describe it, I was just sitting watching her going, wow.
Yeah, she's cool. She's really good.
Beat.
Yeah, well, I'm sort of wondering, like, with there's a lot of interesting things about the film, but the thing I got to ask, though, and I think it's a very, very important question, the shack in the middle of this film, where most of the action takes place. Whose shack does that belong to? And also, like, I love how it sort of becomes its own character in the film. So tell us about how the shack came in part of the film.
That's a good question, Beat. So the shack is two shacks. The exterior of the shack was in Daylesford, and which is a small town in central Victoria, and the interior was in Aries Inlet. So we spent a few days up in Daylesford shooting up there for the exterior, and then the interior shack was actually owned by a mate who I'd gone, another uni mate who I'd kind of, well, I was looking around for something, and he had just bought it, and it was a shack as a kind of a weekend getaway thing, and so they were only there every now and then, and he had plans of renovating it, which he's done. So the shack actually doesn't exist anymore. But it was, he was, his name's Aaron Knight, and he's probably one of my best mates, and he was just so good about it. So whenever he wasn't there, I used to ring him up and go, hey, can we, you know, pour a whole bunch of fake blood around your shack? And he'd go, yeah, sure, go for it. So, and I remember that the last day of shooting we had at the shack, looking around, because we had put plastic on the floor because we were kind of slightly on edge about destroying the shack. And I looked around and most of the floor was covered in fake blood, which is, I don't know if you guys ever made fake blood. It's awesome stuff. It's basically corn syrup and food dye, a bit of red food dye, and then you'd add in a bit of green. And how much you add in depends on how much you want to make it look like Fight Club. But, yeah, it was just spread all over the kitchen floor, and I thought, oh my God, this is, I don't know how we're ever going to clean up. But we got there in the end, and yeah, the shack was awesome. It was, and it's so handy. Like, that was another thing that was really, I guess, fortuitous, that's a hard word to say, and allowed the movie to be made, was these little bits of luck that we had. And one of the bits of luck was that Az had this place that we could film and film there for free on weekends over such a long period of time. So, thanks, Aaron Knight and his family.
Sounds very like things just fell into place, and that probably helped a lot.
Yeah, it did. It was a huge help, and he was so nice to let us use it as well. We really appreciate it.
I was going to ask because maybe I just don't know anything. Is Crow Valley a real place, or why? What's with the name?
No, so the name was, because I was thinking what to call it, and then a location name you can make up, and you can make it sound, you know, when you make it up, you can make it sound a bit scary or a bit, or have that element of, I guess, worry, make people worry, I don't know. But, yeah, it was just made up. Crow Valley sounded pretty kind of dangerous place to be, so as simple as that.
I like it.
Well, it's a good title because it instantly catches your attention.
It does. And it was, there was quite a bit of, like, I remembered it was a bit of a animal and, land type thing. So was it Bear Mountain, Crow Valley, Penguin Ridge? That wouldn't work. You know, there was a bit of there. It would have been interesting if we had called it Penguin Ridge. I don't know whether that would have worked or caught people off guard. But
so you could bring them in thinking that they're going, thinking it's a family film. Then you just, like, terrify them right away.
There's something kind of appealing about that, being able to do that, but it probably would have been. I was actually surprised that the name, what we called it, has been pretty effective, because it's a good catchy name that seems to be catching people's ears, and they go, oh, Crow Valley, what's that all about? So it's been
good. And plus it's kind of ambiguous where in terms of, like, it doesn't sort of say in a, like, spells out what the film is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. So, which is good too. You know, it's going to be a bit scary because Crow Valley can't be a good place, but yeah, it doesn't tell you too much.
But in that case, though, before you settled on Crow Valley, were there any other titles you thought about for the film, or was that always going to be the title?
That was settled on pretty early, because I did do that mix of various names, and but yeah, that kind of came up, and I was like, oh yeah, that's working for me. So yeah, pretty early on in the process, that was the name.
I was going to say something, and now it slipped my mind completely. I'm good at that. But yes, coming soon. Kookaburra's Corner. Probably not.
And the good thing about it too is the release has been going really well. It's, you know, obviously available on Google Play and YouTube Movies now. And it's only early days. Like, it's, I think on Friday we started with that, and I've yet to get some figures coming out, but from what I've been hearing, lots of people have been watching it, so that's been really satisfying. And obviously coming off that, having the release overseas in the US and the UK, that was really exciting too. So it's good to have the – it was kind of good to have the Aussie release after the overseas release, because it feels like it's it's kind of – I was talking to Shell about this the other night, but coming to not a conclusion, but it's like, oh, it was kind of the final hurdle to get to. So to tick that box has been really satisfying. And also with the overseas release, obviously it's hard to get any – there were some reviews and that type of thing, but it's hard to get any real feel. But it's nice now that people are kind of saying they've seen it and, you know, they liked it, and that type of feedback is nice, because it felt like early on when overseas it just kind of went off into the ether. But, yeah, it's kind of – it feels much more real now in a way, in a strange way, that it's been released in Australia. So it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
Well, it is available for streaming on YouTube Movies, Google Movies, Vimeo On Demand.
Yeah. And that's thanks to Bounty Films as well. They put that out and had a lot to do with making that happen. So we really appreciate their help as well.
Yes, absolutely. As always, shout out to our friends at Bounty.
Indeed. But I guess if we have any final questions to ask, and feel free if you can divulge anything. Do you have anything else that you're working on at the moment?
I do, which is I'm really excited about it. It's more of a crime thing in the vein of like Death in Brunswick or Chopper.
Ooh.
So it's an Aussie crime thing. And it has this character, this main character, who I think I'm falling in love with him, because he's the worst. He's just the worst person in the world, and he's been so much fun to write, and I've just enjoyed it so much. So I'm just writing that script now, and I'm kind of in the polishing phase of pretty much, and that will be the next thing that we do. It's a little bigger in scale, but not too much bigger. Bigger cast this time around, and so that's, yeah, I'm really feeling very excited about it, actually. So yeah, that's the next thing. I won't say too much more about it, but very exciting.
Sounds interesting. If you need two lovely people to help you, me and Beta are always available.
Oh, absolutely. God.
Can we get a set visit? We just think we'd be fun.
Let's lock it in now. It probably won't. By the time I, you know, figure out how to actually make it, it'll be another 2 years, but you guys can definitely
come. Yes. Yes.
Well, hopefully we're unforgettable, so.
Absolutely.
All jokes aside, though, thank you for taking the time out to chat with us. It's been a real pleasure, and it's always good to just talk movies and talk about the processes and all the good stuff. So, yeah, I hope people check out the film. Look, I say especially if you do enjoy more indie films and things that aren't quite mainstream, because I think it's definitely worth a watch.
I would definitely check it out. Do yourself a favor. Check out Crow Valley, because as you said, there's a lot there to enjoy about it, and it's definitely a roller coaster ride. Once it gets going, it doesn't really let up. So yeah, we're very proud of it.
Yes, and support your indie filmmakers, because they definitely need it, and they do deserve it. Add that in, they deserve it. But yeah, no, thank you so much.